Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
In just a couple of weeks, in fact, nearly every tree you see here died suddenly and at the same time.
That's a second clip from the ABC Australia television program Catalyst. Find a link to the video and a transcript in my blog at ecoshock.info. If you've just tuned in, our guest is Gail Zawacki, speaking out on the pollution that is killing trees, shrubs, and crops. It just seems like there's kind of a marriage between global warming and ozone pollution, that we're dancing back and forth around it.
It's true that there's a lot of, for instance, the FACE free air enrichment studies in Wisconsin, where they have these gigantic, I think they have like 20 huge chambers where they fumigate the trees. They do elevated CO2, elevated ozone. They mix them together. The scientists are very, very interested in this interaction. And it's something that I don't get all that excited about one way or the other, because I think there's a kind of CO2 obsession that has really predominated in science in the last at least 10 years. And they're not really quite that related. And scientists tend to think they like the idea that, and they'll often say, oh, yeah, ozone's bad for plants, but we can make up for that because the CO2 will take care of that. But they're two different things. I mean, they're just the kind of mechanisms that are going on from ozone damage and CO2 increasing growth are very different. And aside from that, the CO2 increasing growth has always seemed kind of specious to me, because it's kind of like saying it's good for people to eat more calories because they'll grow faster. In other words, they'll get fat. But what are the long-term consequences of that? Nobody really knows. I mean, there have been some studies that have shown that, and in fact, greenhouses will fumigate produce for the grocery store with CO2 because it grows faster. But is it going to have the same strength? Is it going to have the same nutrition? If you go to the grocery store and buy that greenhouse hydroponic stuff that they're fumigating, it doesn't have any flavor. So I'm quite suspect of that as CO2 somehow mitigating ozone problems.
All right. So, Gail Zawacki, how do people find out more about you and your work?
Well, my blog is the best place to go, WitsEnd, NJ, for New Jersey, .blogspot. And right at the top of that page, there's a link to, a couple months ago, I wrote kind of everything I could think of, so it would be one place, and that's called Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute. There's a link at the top, so if anybody wants to download that PDF, it's free, or they could buy the book if they want to have a hard copy, which is $20 at Amazon. So that's a good place. And also, the thing that I wrote, the Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, has huge amounts of links at the end to published research. So it's, you know, I wrote that, but it's all backed up with, for people who like to study that kind of, you know, want to go look at the chemical formulas, that's all there. Every country and every university has websites about ozone, so you can always just Google it. One place to go that's great is called ozoneinjury.org, and it's published by a European consortium. And if you go to ozone injury, so they have forest impacts, and they also have crops. So you can click on the crop link, or you can go to ozoneinjury.org/crops. And the picture you'll come up with right away is an amazing photograph, and it's of potatoes. And one of the experiments they've done, out of many, is they grew potatoes in filtered air. So in other words, there's no pollution. This is very clean air. Then in another chamber, they grew potatoes at ambient air, which has whatever amount of pollution the ambient air has. And then they grew some potatoes in a third chamber where they had added extra ozone on top of what's out there. And the difference in the yield of potatoes is just staggering. To me, that's the biggest image. That picture speaks so many more words. To see how much we're losing in terms of crop yield and extrapolate from that to what's happening to our trees, it's pretty convincing.
And I'm sorry, I missed your blog address. Could you give it to us slowly so people who are listening on the radio might be able to kind of jot it down?
Yeah, it's Wits End. In other words, like I'm at my Wits End, WITSEND, and then NJ, like New Jersey, .blogspot.com.
Got it. Okay. Now, here's a question that we couldn't answer in 3 hours probably, but I have to ask, what can we do to clear the air? What can we do about this problem?
Yeah, so that's a really hard question. And it's one reason that I'm a distinctly unpopular person, I would say, because the only way that anyone knows of is to fundamentally change the way that we live our lives. But there is a lot that we could do, which is why I do write about it, because to me, we are squandering so much fuel. We're wasting it, using it for stupid, unnecessary things like mowing lawns. People could get a sheep or a goat. And those two-stroke engines, lawnmowers and leaf blowers and things like that, they are far worse in terms of emissions than cars even. But the very notion of single-passenger vehicles is just totally unnecessary. It does take a revolution of the mind to do that, to think, well, I'm going to carpool. When I need to go to the grocery store, I'm going to go with my neighbor on the same day, and we'll go together, and things like that. But if we wanted to, for instance, in World War II, when people were faced with a really drastic threat, they took extreme measures without complaining to conserve. They conserved fuel. They rationed essential things. And people's lives weren't miserable for that. Or another example is flying. Flying is one of the worst things that you can do. One trip across country is the same as driving an SUV for 2 years. And when I grew up, the only people that flew were like movie stars and the president. I actually did fly for the first time when I was 18, but I never expected to. I was thrilled. It's not necessary for people to have this lifestyle where they think they can fly, you know, on vacation, or where people have to fly. Or the worst is these eco conferences when people fly from all over the world to get together and talk about how bad, you know, CO2 emissions are. And they get on airplanes to do it. I think there is a lot that we can do. The way I look at it is every morsel of energy that we don't squander today is something that's going to be down the road for grandchildren. But people are very selfish. So it's going to take, which is one reason I think the ozone is important. I feel like if people understood how directly we're threatening our food supply, and not just but the forests are the foundation of our ecosystem. They provide the oxygen that we breathe. They provide habitat for so many animals. And they keep the earth cool with evapotranspiration, by cycling the water from the soil to the air and to the rain. We really can't live without our forests. I feel like if people understood that in a visceral way, maybe then they'd say, okay, I don't really have to fly for this weekend trip after all.
As we wrap up, and I think this is related to what you're just saying, you've been blogging about your recent trips to Occupy protests. Why you, and why Occupy now?
I got that first call from Adbusters last summer to Occupy Wall Street. I got excited about it instantly because it's a movement that's fundamentally challenging the way that our current society is constructed. And that's at the root of the problem of pollution and of climate change. It was a long time ago that I think it was Andrew Jackson complained about or warned about a system where the production of finances and everything is privatized. Profit is privatized, but the risks are socialized. That's the country we live in right now. It's corporate welfare. So that, in other words, somebody's making big profits by burning coal, but the rest of us are the ones who pay the price when we get sick. And Occupy's addressing that kind of social inequity and financial inequity. So, yeah, I've been going to whenever I can. It's a hike for me to get into New York. But I went on May Day, and right now, in fact, this morning, the occupiers are very, very unhappy with the almost, you'd call it a media blackout about what happened on Monday, which was an enormous march. There were tens of thousands of people. So, you know, somebody said 50,000. I don't know. But it was... there were so many people marching down Broadway, all the way from Bryant Park to Battery Park at the very southernmost part of the island. And when you were standing there, you'd look all the way up Broadway, all the way down. We took over the entire street. It was huge, and yet there was hardly any. In fact, some of the media were saying, oh, it really fizzled. And we were all going like, fizzled? We live in a world of propaganda. They're not reporting the truth. So people are quite unhappy right now about the May Day coverage.
This is Alex Smith. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Gail Sawicki from New Jersey. She's an activist who is running a kind of one-woman campaign to wake us up to the continuing clouds of air pollution that kill people and trees and plants of all kind. You can find her blog at Wits End and more links to the ongoing stories of tree deaths around the world in my blog at ecoshock.info. Gail, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
It's been fun and sad, though, and worrying, but that's what makes good radio. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
I talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. I talk to the stars, they never hear me.
Whether you accept climate change science or not, nobody disputes the fact that carbon dioxide levels are growing in the atmosphere as we burn fossil fuels. That changes the way plants grow. Various experts, including some climate modelers, count on increased plant growth as carbon dioxide rates go up in the atmosphere. Others have even promised we'll feed a new, more heavily populated planet with this extra growth. Is it true? Our guest is Lisa Ainsworth, Assistant Professor of Plant Biology and Adjunct Professor of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. She is co-author of one of the more cited papers on the effects of increased carbon dioxide on plant growth. Lisa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I've learned from your work that we can't just ask the simple question, how do plants respond to CO2? Because nature has evolved at least four different ways for land-based plants to use carbon dioxide. I wonder if you could briefly just describe those types of plants for the non-scientist.
Sure. Many of our crops are so-called C3 plants, or they use a C3 photosynthetic mechanism. What that means is that they fix CO2 from the atmosphere with an enzyme called Rubisco, and they do that in the mesophyll cells. With this mechanism of photosynthesis, current levels of CO2 don't saturate the rate of photosynthesis. And so plants with C3 photosynthesis include soybean and wheat and rice, so many important food crops. And they also include, you know, most trees, I think there's only one exception to that rule, have this sort of photosynthesis. And so all of these plants, when given more carbon dioxide, they generally increase their rates of photosynthesis. You can contrast this with so-called C4 plants, and those include maize. And so C4 plants kind of have a supercharged photosynthetic process. And so what they do is they initially fix carbon dioxide via a different enzyme called pep carboxylase into a C4 acid. And then they transport that C4 acid into specialized cells called bundle C cells, where the Rubisco enzyme is held in C4 plants. And then they take that C4 acid and they decarboxylate it, so take a CO2 off of that C4 acid, and then Rubisco does its job. The difference here is that this mechanism provides a way to increase the concentration of CO2 within those bundle C cells, and so Rubisco is essentially saturated by CO2. And so plants that have this mechanism called C4 photosynthesis include corn and sorghum, so some important crops as well. Many of the grasses, the very productive grasses that you find in savannas and other grasslands are also C4. And so it's true that natural selection has evolved different mechanisms of photosynthesis, and so not all plants will respond directly to an increase in carbon dioxide concentration in the same way.
Fair enough. And you and other scientists have developed a new study technique known as free air CO2 enrichment. You call it FACE for short. Why is there a need to go beyond the greenhouse techniques that were used previously?
So what FACE allows is for plants to be grown under high CO2 in the field, and so no enclosures are used at all. So plants are rooted in the ground. There's no disruption of the continuum of water from the soil through the plant to the atmosphere. So that exchange is natural. Plants receive, you know, normal solar radiation and normal precipitation for whatever normal may be in the area that these experiments are. This is important because this probably comes as no surprise to anyone. When you grow a house plant inside your house or when you grow it outside, it's kind of a very different sort of plant. And the same is true for growing a soybean in a controlled environment or in a greenhouse versus growing it outside. You have much more light outside. You have a completely free rooting environment. you have more wind, and that causes the plant to have a slightly different stature. So you have more robust or hardy plants outside. You also have more pests and diseases in the natural world. And so it's quite important contextually to do these experiments in a real-world environment.
Well, why don't we begin with trees? What does open-air testing show about the impact of increasing CO2 on the trees?
For trees, for many of the forests, when they're grown at or exposed to high CO2, for some of the longest experiments have now been run for about a decade, what we find is that initially there's an increase in productivity of these forests. And so if you measure something like total carbon gain by the forest in a given year, say, it's higher in elevated CO2. Where the plants put that carbon is interesting. There's an increase in allocation to fine roots, and so there's more carbon that goes below ground. There's also an increase in above-ground biomass for trees exposed to high CO2. And so some of the longest-running experiments were at the Duke Forest in North Carolina. There was also a long-term experiment in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And these two experiments also had a nitrogen component of their experiments, and these were interesting studies because this sort of the law of limiting resources would suggest that as you add more carbon, something else is going to become limited. And nitrogen is what people had long hypothesized would become the limiting nutrient, at least in the temperate northern hemisphere. And in the case of the experiment at Oak Ridge, that's what was seen. It appeared that nitrogen limitation did develop in the later years of that experiment. And so the increase in growth wasn't sustained. Interestingly, at the Duke experiment, there was kind of a decade-long increase in above-ground production, in part because nutrient cycling was more rapid there. And so there was more increased availability of nitrogen.
Well, what level of CO2 did you expose the plants to, and when do scientists predict we'll reach those levels in our atmosphere?
Okay, that's a really good question. So both of these experiments that I just talked about at Duke and at Oak Ridge exposed plants to about 550 parts per million CO2, and that's about the concentration that's expected for the year 2050, about halfway through this century.
That's not that far away.
That's not far away at all, no. Of course, when these experiments were initiated, it was 20 years ago, and so it seemed a bit further away than it does today. But one of the trends, certainly in emissions over the last decade, is that they've been increasing at a faster rate than previously. Every year, we're now increasing the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere by nearly 2 parts per million. This is really a rapid and precipitous rise in CO2. And so far, to date, there hasn't been any agreements to really slow that rate.
Right. This is Radio EcoShock with plant specialist Lisa Ainsworth from the Department of Plant Biology at the University of Illinois. Lisa, let's go straight to one of the pressing issues for all humans, the impacts of increasing CO2 on crops. Can you talk to us about the big ones like wheat, corn, or some people call it maize, and rice?
Sure. We talked a little bit before about how corn has a mechanism of photosynthesis called C4. So it's sort of a supercharged mechanism of photosynthesis where the rate of photosynthesis is already saturated by current atmospheric CO2 concentrations. And so when we've done experiments growing corn in the Midwest at high CO2, we haven't measured any increase in yield. And so what we expect is that in high CO2, unless water is limiting, we may not see a direct effect of elevated CO2 on yield. In contrast, when we grow soybean at the same site, basically in the same soil under the same water conditions, when we grow them at elevated CO2, and these are concentrations, again, around 550 to 580 parts per million, we see an increase in yield of about 15% on average. Rice and wheat have a similar response as soybean, so on average, when you grow them at 550 parts per million, we see about a 15% stimulation in yield.
But we might have to keep the nitrogen coming to the fields as long as the natural gas keeps coming to provide that. Is that correct?
That is correct. The stimulation is greater under higher nitrogen. If nitrogen isn't provided, then the stimulation in production is less. Those experiments were mostly done in wheat. There has been some work in rice as well. Soybean, of course, fixes nitrogen from the atmosphere. It has an association with rhizobium, which is a bacteria that can fix nitrogen. And so we don't fertilize soybean typically in Illinois, because it has this nitrogen fixation capacity. But we do heavily fertilize the corn that comes before the nitrogen, so there's some there in the soil.
And I've heard that CO2 increases might actually reduce the nutrition in plants, forcing herbivores to consume more just to get the same diet. Is that true?
That is true. And so at the leaf level, what happens when you grow plants in high CO2 is first there's a faster rate of photosynthesis, and so that's the rate at which CO2 is basically taken out of the atmosphere and fixed into a sugar in the plant. So plants make more sugars and they store more sugars in their leaves. If there are more sugars in the leaves, then that dilutes the concentration of nitrogen. So if a bug takes a bite of the leaf, it's getting more sugars and less nitrogen. And similarly, if you look at the grains of many crops that are grown under high CO2, you also have a lower nitrogen content in the grains. And so there is certainly some concern that in a high CO2 world, there may be less nutrients in the grains as well.
One of the reasons you studied increased CO2, it seems to me, in the paper that I read, was to double-check crop production assumptions made by climate modelers like the Hadley Center in England. Is that true, and what did you find out about their assumptions?
And so what we found was that the magnitude of the response was lower in the field. And so while we predicted about a 15%, a little less than a 15% stimulation in yield from the field, at concentrations of about 550. The controlled environment studies projected about a 30% stimulation in, say, wheat and soybean and rice yields at that same elevated CO2 concentration. And so one of the concerns, of course, is, you know, there's an overestimation of the potential for high CO2 to stimulate yields. And certainly that was something that was borne out in many of the FACE experiments, not just the one here in Illinois, but also FACE experiments in Germany and in China and Japan.
Lisa Ainsworth, it's my impression that the free air CO2 enrichment studies do not try to calculate the other impacts of climate change like drought or high night temperatures on plants, but you did find more CO2 might help plants use less water in the future. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. And so I guess there's two things there. I'll address the water issue first. So all plants, it seems, both C3 and C4 plants, reduce stomata conductance in elevated CO2. And so stomata are the pores that are on the leaves and that they allow CO2 to enter the leaf, and they also allow for water to leave the leaf. And so they're important in the exchange of water between the plant and the atmosphere, and they're certainly very important in carbon entering the plant, carbon dioxide entering the plant. And so all plants reduce their stomata conductance at elevated CO2. There are just a few exceptions, but the vast majority of plants reduce their stomata conductance at elevated CO2. And what we found is at 550 parts per million, so the concentration kind of for the middle of this century, they reduce stomata conductance by about 20%. And so what this means is that the plants are using less water. So if there's less conductance, there's less evapotranspiration from the canopy, and that can improve soil moisture status. And so what that means is that many plants can be more water use efficient, have a higher water use efficiency at elevated CO2. Most of the work that we've published from the FACE site has only looked at the effects of elevated CO2, but there is current experimentation where we are catching rain in awnings, so providing a drought treatment to look at the interactions of elevated CO2 in drier soils. And experiments also being led by other colleagues are using infrared heaters to heat the canopy to look at the interactions of higher temperatures in elevated CO2. Because while decades of research has now really looked at climate change impact kind of singularly, we've studied in much detail the effects of rising CO2 on plant processes, the interactions are much more difficult to predict. We certainly are starting those experiments looking at the interactive effects of elevated CO2 and higher temperatures or elevated CO2 and drought.
Well, if plants have an ability to use less water, that sounds like a good thing if we run into more drought, as has been predicted for the subtropics. But it also might change the formation of things like clouds from rainforests, or it could change, make the soil so soggy that we get more flooding. Maybe I'm just not sure that's a good thing.
I think that you're right. It's going to depend on where you are on the planet, and that's going to make a big difference. And certainly the magnitude of, say, a particular drought and the ability of high CO2 to ameliorate a mild drought is clear, but a very severe drought, it may not be a good thing. if a plant grows very rapidly in a high CO2 environment, puts down lots of biomass, and then there's a very, very severe drought, that plant may feel that drought more quickly or may sense that drought more quickly. So it may not always be a good thing, that's true. In terms of modeling the impact on things like stream flow or land atmosphere exchange, I think that there could be benefits, but there also could be negative impacts of changes in water flux between the canopy and the ecosystem.
Well, in your paper in 2004, you noted that open-air CO2 tests have been done in Japan, New Zealand, Switzerland, and several places in the United States, but not yet in the tropics or subtropics, where most of the world's biomass currently grows. Have there been more tests since then to improve our information?
There have not in the tropics. So that is still an area where we have very little information. And part of that is just the matter of building the infrastructure in those areas. It's certainly more difficult, it's more of a challenge, but to date there have not been any face studies in the tropics. And there have also been very few open-top chamber studies in the tropics. So we know very little about how the tropical rainforest will respond to rising CO2. We also know very little about how the African savannas will respond, and those are basically the two most productive ecosystems on the planet.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of a 2009 presentation that Sir James Lovelock, he showed a map to the Royal Society projecting widespread deserts in the subtropics in future centuries if climate change continues, and that would certainly change a lot of our projection about future crop yields, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. I mean, I think that, you know, we haven't actually even talked about how land use change could feed back on this, and that obviously has a big impact on, we get shifts in ecosystems like you just talked about, or if there's continued land use change, particularly in the tropics, that can also feed back very rapidly on the climate and on the potential for different ecosystems to exist in a place.
Do you recommend other papers or websites where people could find out more about this subject?
There's a network of face sites. So SoyFace has its own website. And if you're interested in the work that we're doing here in Illinois on soybean and corn, and that website is www.igb.illinois.edu, and then /soyface. That's SoyFace.
I think I'll put that in my EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info for people who want to grab that link.
And then the Oak Ridge National Laboratory also has a face site, kind of a database of the Aspen face and the Duke face. There was a site in the Nevada desert, and there was also one in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Aspen face was in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And so that site is public.ornl.gov/face.
Okay, well, I'll put those links in and a couple of others that I found. We've just been peering into the murky future of plant growth in a carbon-enriched atmosphere. Our guest has been Lisa Ainsworth, Assistant Professor of Plant Biology and Adjunct Assistant Professor of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. Lisa Ainsworth, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
In the Australian documentary, there is a shot of a forest in Spain that suddenly died. Just a quick picture. The whole thing has died. Even though I've seen millions of dying trees with my own eyes right here in British Columbia, that one photo and all it means hurt me deep inside. I'm Alex Smith, your reporter. As I limp off to lick my green wounds, the forest calls out to us. Will anybody hear? If a tree-